Then, again, those who are fond of very small children go to the school in hell and help them there. As Jack has told you, there are two sets of schools in hell, A, those for the evil souls who are striving to climb out of hell, and, B, for the premature children. The tiny infants and neglected children who never had any chance of learning about God or a future life. Since they have no faith, they cannot dwell in any division where faith is a necessary condition, any more than a fish could live on dry land. Hence, both these types of schools are in the seventh division, that is the highest of hell, but, otherwise, they have nothing in common. R.L.W. Fool, but what of the terrible darkness? It seems very unfair that these innocent children should be plunged into that. H.J.L. Who said they were in darkness? They have as strong light as they can possibly bear. It is given off by their teachers in the buildings in which they live, but Jack can explain all this just as well as I, or I could do that another time, which is more to the point. If you waste much more of Jack's time, he'll have to go before you have told him other matters. R.L.W. Yes, of course. But couldn't I do that sort of work? I love children. H.J.L. Certainly, my boy, and I don't doubt that will be a most splendid work for you to do, but first you must learn before you can teach. Now, tell Jack about your guide. Chapter 15, R.L.W.'s Guide. R.L.W. Oh, yes. After we'd sent the adjutant off, H.J.L. said, "Look over there." Then the wall of this room, opposite where I was sitting, began to grow indistinct. It became like darkened glass, and as I still gazed I realized that I could see nothing else but that great void. H.J.L. and the room itself had vanished. Then, far away in the distance, I saw a faint speck of light. It grew brighter and brighter, as if it were approaching, but I could see no form. Yet I knew at once there was a form, only distant from me an immeasurable space. As when seated on a river's bank some dark night, one gazes down into the black waters and sees just one star reflected there, and the dark waters reflect not only the lone star, but also, in some mysterious way, the vast space which lies between our world and it, so it was now between me and my guide. Then, across the limitless space, came a sound and a voice, like the note of a mighty organ far, far away. It swelled and swelled as it grew nearer, and finally it burst like a tempest upon me. Its music was superb and yet awful. In some such way I could imagine the angel's trump will sound at the last day. If, indeed, there is a last day. Or is it, that for me this was the last day, and this the trump of the archangel calling me to judgment? I know not. But in that manner I can best describe the effect of that mighty cadence. The music was exquisite, yet the pain was intense. It burst on me and over me. It overwhelmed me and shattered me. It beat me to the dust. Yet it was articulate, and the words it spoke were words of comfort and good cheer. "My son, you have started on the right path. You have broken down the outer darkness which shuts me away from you. Go on and prosper little by little. I shall draw nearer and remember, though you may drive me away from you, yet will I never desert you. I cannot draw any nearer than this lest I overwhelm you utterly. I see how even this first vision of me has shattered and dazed you. Grow strong in good works, in loving acts, in unselfish thoughts, and so as you grow more able to bear the sight of the glory, it shall be revealed to you." Slowly the cadence receded, and a great silence took its place. I gazed on the lone star, and it changed from white to blue, and blue to green, and green to orange, and orange to red, and red to purple. The purple grew pale and became like lavender, and the lavender was diffused with pink, which flashed into an extraordinary color which melted into silver. Then waves of darkness rolled over my star, fold by fold. I could see it no more. Slowly the wall of the house became visible, and then I saw H.J.L. He ceased then, and after a time said, "It is impossible to describe that beautiful color, is it not?" And H.J.L. replied, "Yes, there is no such color on earth. It cannot be described." Again there was a great silence, broken at length by the adjutant, who said in an awestruck whisper, "Youngster, that was the most wonderful description I've ever heard. I felt that I was actually witnessing the episode. So did I cried. HJL smiled. So did we all, we saw the forms or his thoughts. It is not so easy here as in the sixth plane, where it is the normal thing, yet here it can be done. Indeed, even on Earth it is occasionally done, so it is not surprising that it should be possible here. Yes, Jack. Rex, by helping the adjutant, has helped himself, just as W.A. did. He has drawn a little nearer to his guide. A good start, a good beginning, but there is a long journey, yet and as you also have a long journey, Jack, you'd better start. A nice inhospitable way to treat a visitor from a far land, I grumbled, but half in jest. All right, stay here. We shall be delighted, but in that case, we shall not get the latest news from the battlefront next Monday, W. Goodbye, boss. Goodbye, Rex. Goodbye, officer. The room swayed, grew pale, and vanished, and I lost consciousness. Chapter 16, Astral Phantoms. June 26, 1916. I again found myself in the house inhabited by RLW and HJL. The adjutant at once questioned me further about the war. I told him how the Greeks had been blockaded and had given in, also that the Russians were still driving the Austrians before them, and that there were signs that we were beginning to bombard the German lines heavily. He was much excited, and pressed me for as much news as possible. Rex then began, I've been having some experience with these astral beings. I mean the non-human ones. I went out by myself and walked out into the country. Suddenly I saw some delightful-looking little elves, just like the fairies of our nursery stories. I was astonished, and stood and watched them gambling and skipping about. Some had wings like those of a butterfly, and others like those of dragonflies and bats. I even saw one little fellow riding through the air on a broom. I was enjoying myself immensely when a huge monster suddenly appeared, and the little people vanished at once. The newcomer was a most repellent creature. It was the sort of thing I imagine drunkards see in DT. It seemed about 10 feet high, and looked like a huge green crocodile in its upper part, but its lower part was that of a naked man. The lower half was not green, but dark brown. As soon as it saw me, it made straight for me. I had nothing in the shape of a weapon, and I fled. Of course, it was very cowardly of me. But really, the sight of the brute had thrown me completely off my guard. I hadn't run far before I saw HJL hurrying towards me. On seeing how the situation was, he rose in the air and shot towards me at a great pace. Seizing my arm, he turned me round and said, "Face it. The creature is less to be feared than the prehistoric monsters you have already seen. They have real souls in them, and this has not. Now, attack it." Even as we rushed at the monster, its form began to shake, and suddenly it broke in pieces, and these appeared to be caught in some current of wind, for they floated off in various directions. "What was it?" I inquired of H.J.L., who replied, "These are astral phantoms. They are a common phenomenon here. It is difficult for me to make you understand what exactly they are. The astral plane is full of masses of astral atoms, and any thought form which comes here might attract these astral forms to itself and clothe itself with them. There are numerous other ways in which these creatures come into existence, but I do not claim to be an expert, nor even very interested in such matters. The thing to remember, however, is that though, as a rule, these have a very transitory existence, yet there are some which succeed in obtaining a form of life by battening on real men. They attach themselves to some weak-minded person who is living on Earth, and suck up his vitality in a similar way in which an evil person who is on the astral plane may obsess a living man. Again, an evil soul which has lost its astral form may seize on one of the astral phantoms and use it for a time as an astral body. It cannot, as a rule, hold it for long, but while it can, it may do a great deal of real mischief. RLW, how can one tell the difference between A, an astral phantom, B, a phantom which is battening on men, and C, a phantom which is inhabited by a real soul which is not its owner? HHL, largely by intuition. You would recognize at once there was a difference between them if you saw them, though you might find it harder to describe where the difference lay. Briefly, C behave very much in the same way as men in the astral state do, but the astral form is rather obviously a borrowed garment and is always trying to break up and decay. But while it is held this, C group shows an intellect at work. A and B are both lacking in this, and act by instinct. In the case of B, however, at times this instinct has developed so far that it most appears to be on a par with the low cunning of a madman on earth. A, just drift round aimlessly, act on the slightest impulse, and have no settled purposes. By this latter characteristic they may be distinguished from the empty astral shells of dead men from which the souls of men have passed out. These, so long as they continue to exist alone, tend to repeat over and over certain acts of the former earth life of the spirit which have become firmly imprinted into their very beings. Thus, many so-called family ghosts are merely empty astral shells which continue to act in the haunted chamber, repeating again and again the murder they there committed, or perhaps the task they used to do there. There is nothing in them by which they can know. That is why, when spoken to, they do not reply. A ghost which can answer is not an empty shell. What it is another matter, and one we will not now go into. RLW What were the fairies? HJL There are many kinds of fairies, but the kind you saw then were the thought forms or dreams of children, which here had clothed themselves with astral atoms. Your monster was of a very different stock, and was essentially evil. It was the wreck of the astral shell of a negro and of a crocodile, which were casually brought together by the astral tides, and, being both still very material, they reunited to form the shape you saw, but, of course, could not survive for long. He ceased. Rex turned to me. Well, you see, I've been learning a lot. But don't you think the adjutant looks a lot better? J. W. I do. I hope it will continue, but I feel I must be going. So, having bidden goodbye to all, I walked through the door, and, as it closed behind me I grew dizzy, and lost consciousness. Chapter 17. The Officer's Work. June 30, 1916. As soon as I saw them, Rex began, "Well, what's the latest news?" I told them various items, and added, "Have I told you about the revolt in Arabia?" "No," they replied together. So I told them about the revolt of the Sheikh of Mecca, and the capture by him of Medina. The adjutant seemed especially pleased about it. I then turned to the officer. "I have not spoken much to you recently. How are you going on?" The officer. "Well. Very well. Very busy and very happy. 2 years ago I would never have thought it possible. In those 2 years I personally have helped over 100 souls, all old soldiers. All were men who were far from being saints, yet, of them all, I have lost only 6. Not bad, 94% brought safely through the dangerous period when men first start on the astral plane. These numbers don't include the large number with whom my organization has dealt. J. W. What has happened to them? Surely they can't all have reasons, passed on to the spirit plane? Dot the officer. No. 32 have so passed on. Of these, only 5 were under 40, however. In each of these 5, there were special reasons, and only one was below 35. J. W. What sort of reasons cause men below the age of 35 to leave the astral plane? The officer. This man was 32 when he died. He was terribly anxious to pass on to the next plane, because he longed to find his mother, who was there. As it chanced, I knew her well. To get clear of his astral body he did all sorts of self-sacrificing things. Even went to the length of helping dead Germans, including several who had treated him when he lay dying. Finally, a strange thing happened. His guide brought him in contact with a man who had been over here or there a long time. This man was living here with his wife, who was a good deal younger. His time to quit the astral plane had come, but not yet his wife's time. The pair were both deeply distressed at the prospect of having to part, and terribly afraid lest they should never meet again. So the soldier and this man made an agreement that the soldier should give the latter his astral body. I don't quite understand how it was done, for, usually, it is not an easy matter to slip out of your astral body before the time has come, but, as the two guides concurred, it was done. So his astral is here, uninhabited, but his soul has passed on to the plane above and joined his mother, J.W. What is your usual modus operandi when helping those who have fallen in the fight? The officer. Very much the same as the methods we used first for your brother and afterwards for his adjutant. Occasionally we don't have to take them away into the great solitude. Sometimes we find they have already fallen into evil hands and are being led astray. This latter has caused us to set pickets round the drink dens and similar resorts. Of course, we do not always succeed in preventing men going to them. Some men are so set on it that it is impossible. When I came over I was that sort. Still, we prevent a good many from being led into them. Then, too, we have some spirits set aside to shadow those evil creatures who try to tempt men to obsess. As soon as one of these harpies gets hold of a young fellow, and begins to suggest that he should obtain earthly pleasures by obsessing, our spirit warns him against doing so. Then a great part of the work of helping the newly slain is by getting them to help others, like your brother is doing with the adjutant. So we have an ever-increasing band at work, and by Jove, we need it. Then spoke. Yes, we are always sending up requests for more helpers, but, even in the sixth plane, they are hard put to it. Never have so many countless Frithausens been coming over before. Old habitués tell me that the Franco-Prussian War hardly made any difference, but that this is quite another matter. LW, I have not had any very striking adventures since I saw you last. The adjutant and I have been out and about several times, but nothing very exciting has occurred. I expect soon I shall have to start trying to help. The officer. Yes, but all in due season. You must learn a little from more first. HJL, I can feel that the dawn is breaking. So goodbye, Jack. And, having said goodbye to everyone, I passed through the door into the dark street. I noticed it was full of visitors, those who were dreaming of those they had lost. They were all hastening away in one direction. I joined the throng. Several were crying out, "Hasten! Hasten! The dawn is breaking. Quickly! Quickly! Or we shall be too late." We seemed to flow out into a plain, and across it like a river. We came to what seemed like a cliff, and passed into a cavern. I heard a roar like the falling of mighty waters. Then I saw why. The cavern broke off, and over its edge the dreamers poured like a river would fall over a waterfall. Down, down they fell, into a vast and limitless darkness. I perceived that everyone's eyes were shut. So far as I could judge, mine were the only ones that were not. Now I was poised on the edge. Now I was falling, falling. Hundreds of others were falling around me and over me. Still falling, then I lost consciousness. Chapter 18. The Recruiting Rally. July 3, 1916. As I approached the town in which RLW now dwelt, I perceived that something unusual was in progress. People were standing at the doors of their houses waiting for something. Then L heard it, the skirl of the bagpipes. There was no mistaking it. I hurried towards the house, and as I did so, the music grew clearer every minute. I found them all standing in the doorway. "What is it?" I inquired. The officer. "A recruiting march. The idea has spread like wildfire. It's partly due to the news of the great advance, which has already reached us by the path of the newly dead. Someone declared that Englishmen here ought to thrash the Germans as their comrades were doing on earth. He declared that there were thousands who had gone out of the fight, and should be brought back into it, and further, that there were large numbers of men who had never yet taken a hand, but with little training would make useful soldiers. As if it makes any difference here who wins a battle on this plain. If we could help our men on earth it would be a different matter. As it is, it will throw back the spiritual progress of thousands. Look at this fellow. See how all my good work is being undone." And he looked at the adjutant in no very friendly manner. To tell the truth, The adjutant was evidently becoming very excited. As the notes of the bagpipes drew nearer and nearer, he became more and more excited. Then they came. Rank after rank, company after company, great lusty fellows. Highland regiment after regiment, thousands and thousands. As they passed, they chanted in chorus, "Fall in, fall in. Come on, you slackers, come out." And as they cried, from every house and street men came hurrying up. They fell in behind the various regiments. See forth with see forth, black watch with black watch. On and on with the skirl of the pipes. Then came cavalry and artillery. Then the sound of a drum and fife band. "Here come the English regiments," cried the adjutant. "No, they are the Welsh fusiliers," cried a soldier in the street, and he was right. Still on they streamed. Soon the Irish regiments were passing, and ever from houses and streets old soldiers came hurrying up. Yes, and recruits began to fail in at the rear, and were promptly taken in hand by busy sergeants, who made them form up in columns of route. Now some of the colonial contingents were passing, and, amid ceaseless cheering, some of the Canadians and Anzacs went by. Then the bands swelled into a deeper note and the English regiments of the line began to pass, interspersed with artillery and cavalry. "Here come the Royal Fusiliers," cried Rex, and began to get almost as excited as the adjutant. Placed his hand on his shoulder. "Keep calm, my boy. You can do no good now. All this is mere glamour, an empty show. It will be of no help to our country, and will only undo all the good we have done for you. Keep calm." The officer was saying something on the same lines to the adjutant, but he seemed not to hear him. Then one of the battalions began to sing, "It's a long way to Tipperary," and it went thundering down the line. A belated Scotch regiment began "Scots where he were Wallace bled." More regiments passed, among them the Grenadiers. Suddenly the adjutant cried, "My God! It's them!" As he spoke, the York and Lancasters came in sight. What a number they were! It made my heart bleed to think that never more would those fine fellows tread the earth. As they passed, a great shout went up. "The adjutant! The adjutant! I'm coming, boys! Come on, W!" And he rushed down the steps and joined up. For a moment Rex hesitated. Then he saw something in H.J.L.'s eyes, and turned away, murmuring, "I suppose it is nonsense, but I feel a bit rotten not going with the others." Again the adjutant cried, "Come on, W." "But our L.W. went inside. Quick march," cried the officer in command. "We've no time to wait while he makes up his mind." And the column swung down the road and was soon out of sight. On and on they came. There were more than 30,000. As near as the officer could judge, it seemed as if it took hours and hours to pass, and every minute it was growing. Every regiment had its tale of new recruits now, all in civilian dress. Then came RAMC and nurses. More men, and still more men. At last it was finished. "The pity of it," murmured the officer. "If it were only of the slightest help, but it is not. Soon they will be at it again, and no one on earth will be one jot the better for it, and countless souls here will be dragged back again into the whirlpool of passion and retard their progress for years. And yet I cannot help admiring them. After all, though they are wrong and do it from ignorance, the spirit is right. I wish I had fallen on the field of battle in this war among my old companions. Let us go in. We shall have to work hard tonight to save your brother. He's been in our hands longer than the other fellow, or he'd have gone in too. I wonder if I shall be able to get the adjutant back again." I found H.J.L. had already started talking to Rex, proving to him that no good would come of this most recent development. Rex admitted that, but was inclined to argue that, nevertheless, he ought to have gone when his senior officer called him, that they would now think ill of him in his own regiment, possibly even say he was a coward. H.J.L. replied that it did not matter a scrap what foolish people in their ignorance said. They who had been here longer were wiser and knew different. Finally, that his duty was now to make progress, and that he was now doing, whereas the other line of conduct was actually wrong, because it would throw him back, and added, "If, by so doing you could really help your country, we would be the last to oppose it, even although that was the price you must pay, but you will not do the slightest good. There are spirits who can and do help on the war, but they do it by inspiring our generals and organizers with new ideas, not by fighting on the astral plane." At length he was a little more satisfied. Then I left. Chapter 19, Shops on the Astral Plane. July 7, 1916. On arriving at the house in which RLW and HJL now lived, I found them there, but no one else. On inquiring where the adjutant and the officer were, they replied that the officer had gone to try and bring back the adjutant, but had not succeeded as yet, and had only once returned, and then only for a short time. HJL, there are an enormous number of men coming over just now, but for the most part they are still full of the battle fury and go on fighting. It will take some time for that to wear off. RLW, I wanted to go and help try and persuade these men to leave off fighting now that they are dead, and, in short, do the same for them that HJL and the officer have done for me. But HJL says I'm not strong enough, and if I do shall probably relapse under the influence of the excitement and throw away all I've gained. HJL, yes, Rex. But in a little time you will be strong enough to do that work, and then you certainly shall. Indeed, you will hardly be able to make much more progress until you do. Soon after this our conversation turned on domestic matters, and time, if I can use that phrase, passed so quickly that I was quite astonished when HJL told me it was time to go. I then said, "We have had a pleasant but not a very instructive time." He replied, "Still, a respite is rather good sometimes, and indeed today, owing to the setback caused by the return to the front of the officer, has left us with little fresh to tell you. Still, we have learned a lot from you about the war, private affairs, and so forth, which has greatly interested us." Then we parted, and I walked out of the town into the countryside when, lo, a great fog seemed to overwhelm me, and after groping amid the darkness, I lost consciousness. July 10, 1916. On entering the house I met the officer hurrying out. "Hello," I cried, "won't you stay?" The officer: "No, I must get back to my work, though just now it's rather a thankless task," and he disappeared. I went inside and found HJL and RLW there, as usual. "I'm teaching Rex chess. He knew just very little more than the moves, but he's getting on. W, do you know Burmese chess?" "No." "W, would you like to learn?" So there and then I sat down and showed them the game. I noticed the pieces were a rather fine Indian set of carved ivory, and said, "Where did these come from?" "Oh, some that have been destroyed lately." "JW, yes, but how do you get such things here?" "HJL, there are places here, you might call them shops, to which the astral forms of destroyed things come. Thus, there are some shops where chessmen come because there are other chessmen there. These I found in a shop full of carved ivory goods. Such a collection of stuff you never saw in your life. There were dozens of incomplete sets, the rest being still on earth. There were all kinds of ivory work and curios of all sorts, some beautiful, others positively ugly. An old man was there who, when on earth, has been a curio dealer. When he died he came here, and seeing this weird curio shop without an owner, took up his abode there as we have here. He says it is very strange the way all sorts of things suddenly appear there. He never sees them arrive, but just finds them there. But next time, if we are not better employed, I'll take you round to him, and he shall tell you more about it. You'd find him rather a congenial companion. J. W. But do you buy thing here as on earth? HJL, I didn't buy these things. I just told the old man I wanted a set, and he showed me several lots and let me choose this set. He said he felt sure he would be having some more in soon, and in any case he had plenty of other sets. I believe there are a few people who run shops for the joy of selling and even try to cheat their customers as they used to do on earth. They are preparing themselves thereby for the upper divisions of hell, into which the materials drift. I've never thought anything, however, so don't know a great deal about it. I've never bothered about getting money here, so I should be out of it anyway, J. W. But can you get money here? HJL, I suppose you can get its astral form just as you can that of other things. Yes, I remember seeing a miser once, sitting in a scrubby little villa, although there were plenty of fine houses standing empty close by. He was counting and recounting his money.